If cinema is truth 24 times a second, then consider us guilty of perjury. This is CinemaVille.
Welcome to CinemaVille, a brand spanking new podcast dedicated to motion pictures in all their forms. Movies, television, YouTube, cutscenes, and video games. All that jazz. My name is Bob Clark. I'm a cartoonist and animator, and you can see my work at neowestchester.com. Today, we're kicking off the countdown of the greatest science fiction films over at Wonders in the Dark, a great little New Jersey movie blog where I've written more than a few pieces on sci-fi over the years, though mostly Star Wars and anime. I'll be covering a number of films in the countdown on this podcast for the next couple of weeks. And we start today off with number 100 with a bullet. Or perhaps I should say, with a laser. Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace, released in 1999 and directed by George Lucas. The first in the long-fabled prequel trilogy, The Phantom Menace tells the story of how young Anakin Skywalker was first discovered by the Jedi Knights, off on a rogue mission to save the peaceful planet of Naboo from the clutches of the Trade Federation, a greedy corporation with a private army of battle droids and connections to the mysterious Dark Lords of the Sith, who not only have plans to take over the galaxy, but also have plans for young Skywalker himself. I'll be talking with friend and Manhattan cable access legend Checkerville of Checkerboard Kids about this movie and its enduring legacy as one of the most famous and infamous Hollywood blockbusters of the past 20 years. But first, I'd like to take a brief moment to talk about another of the most famous and infamous Hollywood productions, and the brilliant man behind it, who we lost this past weekend. I'm talking, of course, about Heaven's Gate from 1980, and the recently departed Michael Cimino. Heaven's Gate is one of those movies that, for most of the time since its release, has been more famous as a punchline than as a movie itself. Not a lot of people bother to see the film, which tells a bleaker-than-bleak fictionalized version of the Johnson County War of Wyoming in the 1890s, where wealthy cattle barons hired an army of gunmen to wipe out Eastern European immigrants. But everybody seems to have an opinion about it. Ask any given movie buff, and you're likely to hear that it's the movie that killed the legendary New Hollywood system of the 1970s, an out-of-control production that bankrupted United Artists and ushered in a conservative movie system that only cared about blockbusters, box office, and bottom lines. Or, you might hear that it's just a bad movie, bloated and self-indulgent to the max, a film stuffed with poor writing, hammy acting, and needlessly long scenes that stretch out for over 3 hours for no real reason. Or, if you're very lucky, you might hear that it's one of the best movies ever made, an overlooked gem telling a seldom-remembered story deep from the history of the American West, a diamond in the rough that's only just begun to recover in the eyes of the film community after its remastered release by the Criterion Collection. That's what I'd like to tell you, about how it's one of my favorite movies of all time. Well, one of my favorite movies that isn't animated, set in space, or subtitled at any rate. I'd like to tell you about how its beautiful cinematography, inventive set pieces, and rich period detail and music more than make up for its shortcomings, and how even those shortcomings are a lot easier to deal with in an age that makes binge-watching 10 hours of a TV show at a time an ordinary weekend habit. But instead, I think the best thing to talk about is how Cimino's career was more or less ruined by the critical hostility that Heaven's Gate endured, even more than its commercial failure at the box office. Cimino went from being a golden boy on Font Terrible after his breathtakingly quick Oscar wins for The Deer Hunter, and critics seemed to come to Heaven's Gate with their knives already sharpened, eager to take him down a notch for his artistic ambition. The troubled production only helped to give them ammunition for the blitz that came when the film was released, and ever since, it's been that critical excommunication that helped keep him from attaining the same heights as a filmmaker, limping from one botched production to the next until he finally stopped directing altogether in the mid-90s. Heaven's Gate became a buzzword for the dangers of auteur-driven cinema and helped up the pace of commercialism in the industry, putting us down the path we're on today, where nearly every major release is a sequel or remake or both of some kind, and where most of the major Hollywood franchises are owned by the same entertainment company, one which displays an increasingly passive-aggressive relationship with independent-minded filmmakers. Cimino is one of the handful of names that's most often blamed for the situation we have today with the movies. An example of auteurism gone too far that demonstrates the risk of giving artists too much sway over costly productions. Lucas and Spielberg might be the ones who made blockbuster cinema popular enough that every studio in town wanted to imitate them to death, but Cimino is the one who's best remembered as the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo, the one who made it impossible for risky passion projects like Scorsese's Gangs of New York to be made for another decade or two, if at all. But I can't accept that logic, because Heaven's Gate is one of those risky passion projects. You can't hate Heaven's Gate for making another Heaven's Gate impossible. Instead, we should be mourning the loss of all the Heaven's Gates we're not getting a chance to see in this uber-franchise-driven world, just as much as we should mourn the loss of the man who made it. It's become increasingly rare to see even blockbuster entertainment made with the same kind of independent artistic passion that guys like Lucas and Spielberg made their masterpieces on. All you have to do is look at the hostile reaction that the prequel trilogy or even the recent release of the BFG have gotten to see that one-of-a-kind artists are, well, one-of-a-kind. They don't always fit in. And once you start losing them, either to death or to retirement, they run the risk of going extinct. So please, in the wake of Cimino's oddly appropriate Independence Day passing, and on the eve of an election driven on much of the same spirit of greed and anti-immigration furor as you might have found back in the blood-stained prairies of 1890 Wyoming, let's take some time to speak up in favor of all the one-of-a-kind artists out there. The ones who don't just get universal praise from critics and audiences, but the ones who are willing enough to express themselves even if it means alienating viewers. Let us now praise infamous men. Well, now that I've got that out of my system, let's get down to what's really important. Pod racing, Darth Maul, and intergalactic filibustering. This conversation was recorded between myself and Checkerphil of the Checkerboard Kids show after the two of us watched The Phantom Menace together. Him for the third time in 17 years, and me for, well, let's just say more than the third time. Let's listen.
You're definitely more of an old-school Star Wars fan than I am. You're, like, a more old-school fan of a lot of things than I am, so...
Yeah, it's because I'm an oldster, my good man. I do admit that.
The other thing that I know that you're a big fan of is Rocky Horror, and, like, that was already out a few years.
Oh, right? No. I got into Rocky Horror, like, when I got into high school, and I got into high school maybe, like, 1981, you know? Mm-hmm. So, like, yeah, so... But Star Wars, I was there at 77. I was, like, a little kid, you know?
All right, so you were there basically your first generation Star Wars. I'm, like, at best, second generation. I'm, like, one of the people who started seeing the movies all on, like, videotape. I watched, you know, it's funny, the first times that I ever watched Star Wars, and the first, like, the ages when I was able to, like, watch them and almost commit them to memory, What I was watching it from was it was taped off of TV, off of Channel 2. They were showing it around Valentine's Day, and included in the videotape that we had for some reason was the Charlie Brown Valentine's Day special.
Ah, it's Valentine's Day Charlie Brown.
Right,
okay.
So that's how I was used to seeing Star Wars all when I was, like, growing up.
With commercials?
Yes, with commercials. Like, whenever I was watching it, like, I'm pretty sure between the portions where, like, the droids go into the sandcrawler and before you see, like, the stormtroopers come out, I'm almost absolutely positive one of the commercials was by Menon.
Okay. So you didn't know about fast forwarding, did you?
Well, the thing is, when you're that little, you get to be so used to it that you want to watch it with the commercials just because that's how you're used to seeing it.
Ah.
You know, that's how it imprints upon you. So when, like, the special edition came out and, like, people were complaining about all the changes that were being made to Star Wars, I'm sitting there and I'm just thinking, what, you guys have it easy. I have to get used to the fact that I'm not watching Snoopy and Woodstock before a Star Wars movie. So, you know, just like...
Luxury problems, my friend. Luxury problems.
Right, it's like, right, I mean, God, come on. Oh, no, Han is stepping on Jabba's tail. Big deal. I have to get used to the fact that we're not seeing, like, you know, commercials for, like,
right.
Captain Power or shit between then or something. Mm-hmm. Who cares what shit's been added in?
What I saw from this viewing, I noticed this movie was mostly about politics.
Partly about politics. It's not entirely that, but what's interesting to me is that the politics that are in the movie almost feel like they were written for today, because it's all about these, like, big greedy corporations trying to escape paying their taxes. I mean, like, I think the best way to describe The Phantom Menace in terms of its plot is... it's like Flash Gordon written by Bernie Sanders. But anyway, 1999, that's when all the political stuff that was going on here makes the most sense. And where were you just like in that year coming to see the movie for the
1999.
First time?
Oh, let's see. 1999 was the year Matrix was out and in full swing.
Yes,
so it was a lot of hazy, partying, kind of wild years of my youth, you know.
Which kind of hazy partying are we talking about? Are we talking the hazy rave techno goth
stuff? Like that
kind
of stuff.
Or are we talking like the second Matrix movie where they're like they've got the drum circle going?
No. Yeah, that's where they started getting very what's that called? Where everybody gets dirty. What's that thing called? Burning Man. Very Burning Man.
Mm.
So no, the very ravey was at that time.
Where, like, what were the fandoms that you were in, like, in 1999? Just to give me, like, an idea.
Oh, no, please. I was always in the same things that I was always into. Always into the comic stuff, always into the Rocky Horror stuff, always into...
give me some
movies,
examples.
Movies weren't happening, the Marvel movies weren't happening like it used to. The last thing they came off was with that bad 1995 Fantastic Four film that went straight to, like, not even to videotape, straight to the underground. Was it a lot of Vertigo comics were out, like...
Yeah, there was a lot of Vertigo...
Yeah,
that was the time of The Preacher.
Oh yeah, heck yeah, Preacher at its best of sure. So there was that a lot, that Sandman stuff like that, and you know that's what I was reading a lot of that stuff back then.
Yeah, I mean, like I feel like that era is like you had a lot of the glory days had just recently passed on a lot of the old guard of comics and a lot of the old guard characters. Like you had Claremont off of X-Men for a while. The biggest, like, characters were all in, like, their dying or existential phase. You know, Superman died for a while.
Right.
Batman's back was broken for a while.
Right.
Spider-Man thought he was a clone
for a while.
Captain
America got shot.
That's Civil War.
All right, so that's after.
That's in the Bush administration.
Okay, sorry.
We're talking the Clinton years. Like Clinton-era comics... I feel like, yeah, the best stuff was, like, the Vertigo stuff that you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
or, like, some of the other stuff that, like, Alan Moore was doing. This is really where, like, the experiment... Like, you know what? Image was just starting out then.
Ah.
So, the big... Like, if you had to choose one superhero who is, like, the big emblematic character
of the
90s...
I guess it would be Spawn or something?
It would be Spawn.
Yeah,
it would definitely be Spawn.
And he had his own series, too. So,
yeah,
his own animated thing going on there, too.
And, like, what's some of the anime that you were, like, in then? Was it just, like, the recent stuff, or just, like, I know you're into a lot of...
Old stuff, man. I was always into the old stuff. I was always into the Rumiko Takahashis, you know. Any, whatever Rumiko Takahashi... And I didn't like much, like, Mermaid Scar, but I was all into... I liked some of the Inuyasha stuff, but I go further back from that. I'm all, like, Utsura Yatsura... And okay, wait. Let me back it up.
Urasai
Yatsura. Am I saying it right? No. But my main thing of all, for me, personally, my favorite out of all animations is Rurouni Kenshin. That was my joint right there. Nah, don't tell me no Samurai X, because the people that are all doing the Samurai X thing, you know, I didn't like the dubs. I wanted to hear it as pure Japanese. I liked Rurouni Kenshin. That was my joint right there. I loved it.
That's a lot of the stuff that I was into then. Not those particular shows,
mm-hmm.
but, like, for me at that point, like, when, like, say, 98, when, like, the first big rumblings of the prequels started coming out, at that point I felt like I had already gotten, like, I was already sort of done with Star Wars for a while. I had kind of gotten it out of my system, you know what I mean? Like, what is it? I see the special editions, 97. I finally get, you know, the big screen Star Wars experience, and I get the videotapes and widescreen and everything so I can enjoy it in all its letterbox compositional glory. But at that point, Star Wars itself, it felt like it was leading me away. You know, Star Wars was leading me away from Star Wars, because whenever I was, like, you know, if I was, like, watching Star Wars, I might have also been, like, reading... interviews that George Lucas was doing where, like, they would say, like, oh, what are the things that inspired you? And he would say, you know, oh, I was watching, like, in film school, I was watching a lot of Kurosawa movies. I was watching Godard, Fellini. And every time I saw those things, I would be like, okay, I got to make my list. I got to watch. Because I was getting into those things, I was getting into foreign cinema and art cinema and all the things that, like, built Star Wars from the early days. Like, I was watching THX. A lot when I was that age, I felt like I was beginning to drift away from Star Wars, and I didn't quite care that much. At that age, I was getting into anime for, like, in a big way, because, like, you know, what is it? I'm 10 years old, I see Akira for the first time, blows my mind. Then, like, you know, Sci-Fi Channel comes on, and they have Saturday animes.
Okay, what were they showing?
They would be showing, like, the sad thing is they're showing, like, a lot of edited stuff.
Of course.
But, you know, they're showing Robot Carnival, which is great.
Oh, sure.
They're showing Project Eiko. They're showing Urasai Yatsura 2, Beautiful Dreamer.
A beautiful film.
And, you're right. And that was my first introduction to Mamoru Oshii, the director who later went on to do the Pat Labor films and Ghost in the Shell. And what was great about those movies that I really like, you know, Pat Labor, Ghost in the Shell, is how political they were at the same time. Like, this was not just a naked chick shooting a bunch of bad guys.
So no fan service. No, but there was fan service too.
Oh, there was fan service, believe me. Maybe not as much fan service as the original. Like, have you ever read the original manga Ghost in the Shell?
No, I believe I've seen it, but no.
It's so weird because it goes from really, really dense, hard sci-fi, like, you know, Masamune Shiro, he's really thought out how cyber brains would work and how these cyborg implants would work. Then it goes to, like, really, you know, densely thought out political paradigms. Like, you know, he's still got the Soviet Union going there, but he has a convincing version of it running. He's got, like, you know, Japan in some sort of stalemate between the Soviet Union and the United States. You've got corporate espionage everywhere. It's really fascinating. But the thing is, in between that and in between the action that you always have in Ghost in the Shell, of course, you also have flat-out lesbian porn.
Ah.
And I mean, like, it's so sudden when it turns up. It's not in the American release of it because, you know, it was cut out for any number of reasons. But in the original Japanese version, like, she has, like, this side business where I don't know what it is. She's having, you know, hardcore lesbian sex to create drugs for cyborgs.
What?
I didn't see that in that film. It wasn't in the film. It was in the manga.
I didn't see that. Oh, okay, all right.
Okay, and here's the thing. He doesn't even just draw hardcore graphic lesbian fan service sex. He footnotes it.
What?
He footnotes it and gives you an explanation as to why she's having lesbian sex and not having sex with a male cyborg. She, you know, he's coming up with a justification that, oh, all cyborgs technically have to have, you know, homosexual sex with other cyborgs because just flood their sensation. It's really just a whole lot of bullshit that he came up with because he didn't want to have to draw a guy's naked body.
Okay, I get it. All right, well, let me throw this out to you. Here are some of the other films that were popular in 1999. So I'll throw that out to you and see what you think about these films.
Okay, Rock Me Amadeus.
All right, Fight Club.
Ooh.
That was a good one. I've seen that several times. All right, of course, Matrix, like we said.
Yeah, there's a very strong political and kind of cyberpunk undercurrent.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you'll notice it, and also very kind of sex thing here. Eyes Wide Shut, mm-hmm. Cruel Intentions.
See, you know what? Eyes Wide Shut, that is the movie that I was looking forward to when I first heard about it, like in 1998. Like in 1999, that was going to be a big year because Stanley Kubrick was coming back to direct. Terrence Malick was coming back to direct with The Thin Red Line, and George Lucas was coming back to direct with The Phantom Menace. And at that age, at the age of, like, you know, 14 or whatever, the one I was not really all that interested in was George Lucas. I knew that I was going to go see the movie, but I didn't really care to go, like, watch the trailer. The one who I was really interested in due partly because of watching Star Wars and seeing what inspired it, was Kubrick.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, like, I was really upset when, like, Kubrick died. The day that Kubrick died...
Right, he didn't finish the film.
Right. He basically finished the film. He didn't have, like, he got a first cut of it done, and then, like, Warner Brothers, like, tampered with it and put people in front of, like, some of the hardcore sex and stuff
right.
in the movie. But when he died, the same day that he died, Joe DiMaggio died.
Ah.
So guess who got the front page?
Joe DiMaggio.
Joe DiMaggio got the front page.
Or in New York City.
Right, and I was so pissed off at that. I'm like, the greatest director who ever lived has died, and you're putting him, like, way back in the paper, man.
Well, you don't understand how important sports are to people, because we're movie people, and we don't care about those sports stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like, Joe DiMaggio ever was to me was a Simon and Garfunkel lyric.
And Marilyn Monroe's husband.
Yeah, but even then, I was more a fan of, like, Arthur Miller.
But you know what? That's that kind of nimbishy, nerdy kind of thing. You can expect that. But here's some films that were interesting that came out. I'll throw these films out to you.
There's American Beauty, right?
American Beauty is definitely their version. Suicide's another one. Mm-hmm. Magnolia, which is another film that confused lots of people.
I thought that was 2000.
1999. It must have been at the end. Iron Giant.
Yeah, the Iron Giant. That's, like, one of the big animated movies. There's not a whole lot of anime that's out in 99.
Right. It was a time for weird films, which was like Being John Malkovich and Blair mm-hmm. Witch Project, and of course, what's his name? The Sixth Sense came out.
Yeah. Well, so, I think that was 98.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, they have it listed as 99.
Okay, well, it's 99.
Toy Story 2. So Disney getting that money, as always. Galaxy Quest came out. That was funny.
Galaxy Quest is legitimately a better Star Trek movie than a fair number of other Star Trek movies. It's certainly a better Star Trek movie.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
It's
that's
certainly
true.
Better than the newer ones.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, I am somebody who thinks the motion picture is probably the best one.
Mm. Dogma, which I personally enjoyed. Yeah, you know who really enjoyed that film? Oh, Dogma? Prince.
Dogma is a movie I was really excited to see. That was like the first Kevin Smith's movie I saw in the theater.
And him really talking about like the comic book industry and stuff.
Yeah.
That's what I really dug about.
That movie, I think, Kevin Smith has another dogma in him. I want to believe he has another dogma in him. Something
well, really,
like
you think Yoga Hosers is gonna get that?
No. I think in one sense he has to go back to like the Catholic.
Go back, Blood and Fire. Kevin, listen to me. Go back to Blood and Fire.
Yeah, well, not so much Blood and Fire,
no, I'm just
but
kidding.
Poop and Fire.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what Dogma is.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but, like, what I'm sensing in there is, like, there's the big undercurrent of the movies of 1999. You get a lot of politics and a lot of alternate sort of psychology and alternate spirituality in there. And I think that even a movie like Being John Malkovich or Fight Club, and especially The Matrix, it fits right into this idea of the world being more of an elaborate con, more of an illusion than you mm-hmm. think it is.
Right, right, and that inspired the Inceptions and the
right.
other kind of twisty things.
Right, and what's all, and but the other thing, of course, is that maybe not so much the case in, like, Being John Malkovich or Fight Club, but mm-hmm. in the case of The Matrix, of course, so much of that is straight from things like Ghost in the Shell.
Right.
Right.
Oh, guaranteed, yeah, for right. sure.
And what's interesting to me here is that as much as you would think that, like, Star Wars in that time is going to be a throwback to the 70s, and as much as you think that, like, you know, back in the day that, like, The Phantom Menace was going to be something like, you know, just like a pure 70s flashback thing, it was bringing a lot that was new to the table. And it was specifically bringing a lot that was new to the table that makes it a movie that I think is much more in common with the Fight Clubs and the Matrixes mm-hmm. in terms of its political content and its sort of like quasi-new agey stuff that's mm-hmm. going on in the movie. It has a lot that is linking it to those things because mm-hmm. it is a movie that is very, very skeptical and questioning of political powers that be and the motivations of the people who are coming up with all of these big political schemes. And its lead character, for the most part, is a guy who endorses a very kind of niche view of the Force.
Okay, so, he's going completely against everybody. He's the rogue.
Yeah, Qui-Gon and, like, the whole vision of the living Force, the religion of the living Force, and, you know, everything with, like, the midichlorians and the Chosen One. This is not a Star Wars, this is not the Star Wars that people were used to, say, in the 70s, and the 70s and 80s, I should say, and as much as people were reacting negatively to that, and they mm-hmm. have been reacting negatively to that for, like, the past 17 or 16 years or whatever,
mm-hmm.
all of that stuff is really the stuff that makes me the most interested in it. And I think that, yeah, that is part of what makes it a kissing cousin to movies like Fight Club and Eyes Wide Shut.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I mean, I love the scene where he's there. Qui-Gon is explaining to the Jedi Council, and they're all, like, rolling their eyes at him, like, tall police.
Right, right. That's the thing that was really cool to me. Qui-Gon is the Jedi that you always imagine when, like, Obi-Wan or Yoda are talking about the old days of the Jedi in the original trilogy.
Uh-huh.
And then the Jedi Council themselves, they're really a bunch of, like, you know, petty stuffed shirts.
They're the political guys that are sitting there like, oh, we got to talk this out.
Right, like, a lot of these, like, they probably have been sitting in those chairs and
they're
going
like
to meetings like that. They're exactly like the Senate. I mean, the visual parallels are very, very clear. These guys have been sitting on their asses for, like, 10 years. They're like, you know, they're like these people who, you know, they fought their battles years ago. They've risen through the ranks, and now they're just sitting there and, you know, they want to be the ones in power.
They're like knights and stuff like that that have no villains to, like, fight anymore.
Yeah.
Like, superheroes that are like, all the villains are gone. And you're saying, like, he's like, dude, I just fought somebody. Seriously, they were bad guys. I think they were Sith. And he's just like, and they're like, why don't we have a meeting about this and see, like, I don't know, Sith haven't been around for a while, man.
Yeah.
I don't think there's going to be some
Sith. Yeah, it's a real Twilight of the Heroes sort of thing with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but yeah, that was, like, but that, like, was my mindset of, like, going into these movies. I was more interested in those things, so when I did, like, go and see The Phantom Menace at that point, being more into, like, the aesthetic side of cinema mm-hmm. and being more into, like, you know, the politics at the time, like, I mean, shit, 1999 was also the year of, like, the World Trade Organization in Seattle and stuff
sure.
like that. So it was almost perfect that you had a group of villains called the Trade Federation invading this small little ideal planet. If you squint your eyes just right, Naboo could sort of be Seattle without a Space Needle or something. The parallels were there in my mind. So I was going in there and enjoying it for that and for the action and just for the way that Lucas was, like, shooting his scenes and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But your reaction to it at first was somewhat different, I would imagine.
Yeah, so my reaction was, like, I was like, oh, come on, boring, get to the fighting already! You know,
although, that's the other thing, there's a lot of fighting in this movie.
Yeah, I know, but then when it was like, I was like, dude, what's with this pod race? This is like 10 billion years long, it's so loud!
I feel like the pod race and stuff like that, there's a big generational component to that.
Ah.
When you're growing up, the first thing you might think of when you look at the pod race, maybe you think of Ben-Hur, maybe you think of, like, Formula One or NASCAR. I'm guessing you were probably thinking of Wacky Races.
Yes, I was definitely thinking of Wacky Races with the homeboy as a kind of, like, the Dastardly and Muttley all rolled into one.
Yeah. Me and, like, people my age, I was thinking Mario Kart. I was thinking Wipeout and games like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, when I'm watching, you know, the pod race as a kid the first time, I'm invested in it because I feel like, oh, yeah, I've experienced stuff like this. Did you ever see the movie Hackers?
No, I didn't.
Okay, the movie Hackers is this, like, you know, like this uber 90s version of what it's like to be, like, a teenage computer hacker sticking it to the man, uh-huh. going up against evil corporations
and stuff.
Kind of a
Mr. Robot of its time.
Absolutely a Mr. Robot of its time. Mr. Robot, I can't tell if they give it a shout-out or if they're making fun of it in one scene.
Mm.
But, like, one of the things about the movie, one of the things that stuck out to me about the movie Hackers is there's this one scene where they all go to, like, this bar arcade place.
Yeah.
And, like, the main character, Johnny Lee Miller, he shows up Angelina Jolie and makes her his enemy by beating her ass at Wipeout, the racing game. So it's like, what's interesting there is that there's a lot that makes that movie sort of, to me, like a proto-Phantom Menace, only with catchier music and Angelina Jolie with a cute pixie cut.
Huh.
If there was anything that was going to improve Phantom Menace, it would have been Angelina Jolie in a pixie cut, I gotta admit.
Sure.
But the fact that you have, in the middle of this movie, for absolutely no reason, they're playing Wipeout and you're watching him, like, race along in the computer and blow shit up, it's like, it's basically like you got a pod race in there for some reason.
And much better than, like, say, that of a Tron, Tron Resurrection. What was that, the new Tron
movie? That was a Tron Legacy?
Yeah, okay.
Tron Legacy?
Mm-hmm.
But it, hey, there you go. That's another thing that maybe the pod race sort of ingrained in me. There's, you know, the light cycle thing.
Yep.
So I think that there's enough, like, your generation maybe, you grew up and you watched the light cycle. My generation grows up, we experience light cycle.
Right, right, right.
So we're able to get into that a little bit more easily. And I wonder if that's one of the things that helps people get into a lot of different action scene types nowadays, because you feel like you've had a kind of virtual first-hand experience at it.
Mm-hmm.
You can understand the grammar of scenes that other people who are older and aren't used to it might not be able to get into. And I
us old codgers, we just can't wrap our heads around it. It's just too much for us.
You know, there's a little bit of that going on in the original Star Wars movies, too, where when, you know, I think there were, like, older audiences, when they first saw that, they weren't able to get into things like the Death Star battle, the trench run, and stuff like that, because they weren't really used to experiencing these sorts of scenes in games. Even, like, the graphics that they're looking at on the screen, they look like old Atari games.
Exactly.
But younger audiences were able to get into it because they've done at least some of that, so they were primed a little bit, and that effect becomes double-fold. I think the action scenes in general, there's something interesting going on in those, like, in just in this movie, the way that Lucas uses the camera. What do you think there?
Well, yeah, he has very visually, I mean, he's one about composition, and you were talking about using the full screen before, earlier, and we really saw that. It was really going on, and I do agree. You've swung me over to your side talking about, like, These scenes that you really need the full screen for. You need to be able to see there's action going on here, there's action going on there. And
I mean, something that I was mentioning before, and this is like one of those moments that I really, like, had to experience it like this. Star Wars was the set of movies that really got me to really care about seeing things in widescreen, seeing things in letterbox. Like, when the special edition came out, I had to have it in widescreen because I needed to see those full compositions again. And then seeing for the first, and it's, that's the thing, Phantom Menace was the first time that I saw a Star Wars movie for the first time in its full widescreen version, and I can't help but be won over by that, just the way that he uses the screen and uses the full scope of the screen throughout the whole thing. Like, there are very often moments in the movie, like, say, where Qui-Gon is fighting, like, a couple of battle droids, on the right side of the screen and in the relative background, and then Obi-Wan will jump in and he's chopping up battle droids on the left side of the screen in the foreground. There's a little bit of, like, the same instinct that I think, like, a Brian De Palma has when he uses split screen or when he uses, like, split diopter or something, where he has action that you're supposed to be looking at on both the background and the foreground at the same time on different sides of the screen. It shows that this is from a generation of directors, Lucas and De Palma, who value and privilege using the entire screen well. Not just using the entire screen to flash you and dazzle you with style, but filling it with stuff that your eye does have to look at and is rewarded for looking at. This is a movie that you need the whole screen to really appreciate in full.
Mm.
It's like I was saying before, like, with Blue Velvet. First time I ever saw Blue Velvet, the only David Lynch things that I'd seen were, I had seen Twin Peaks.
Yep.
And I had seen
Eraserhead.
Eraserhead, right. Yeah. And both of those movies are okay. And no, both of those things are perfectly okay to watch on television. You don't need widescreen for those. You know, Twin Peaks was shot for television, so you really didn't need widescreen for it. Blue Velvet is different. You need letterboxing for that. Because if you just see a pan and scan version, you're seeing about a third of the screen, and you're losing all of the composition. So things that are shot in one way take on a completely different meaning. Like, say, when Dennis Hopper is beating up Isabella Rossellini, in the pan and scan version, all you see is him beating her up, and that's all you get, the context of, you know, him beating her up. In the widescreen version of it, you also see, like, a big long shot of the apartment, and it gives you that voyeuristic feeling, so that you're not just watching, you're aware that you're watching, and there's a big difference between those two things.
Right, right.
So,
yeah, you could see these guys did their homework with lots of homages towards other things, and it's just like, you know, these are lovers of cinema in general, and they bring that to you.
Yeah, I mean, even if you're just going by this one movie alone, and the other movie, and the other prequels, and the other Star Wars movies in general do this too, you know, I mean, I look at this again, there are so many shout-outs, both to the Kurosawa movies that people were used to getting from, like, Lucas in terms of homages, but also just a lot of, like, old-school classic Hollywood and classic science fiction. Like, the moment when the Jedi are first battling the droids on the Trade Federation ship.
Okay.
And, like, Qui-Gon is trying to cut through that big blast door, and he's, like, you know, he's shoving his lightsaber in, and the other side of the door is beginning to, like, turn white-hot magma and burn off. That scene is, like, that is taken directly from Forbidden Planet.
Okay. Forbidden Planet?
Yeah,
okay.
Forbidden Planet. I'm talking the movie, not the comic book store here.
Okay, okay.
Okay, and that's like, you know, that's the old movie with, like, Walter Pidgeon and Leslie Nielsen.
Right, right.
You know, Anne Francis stars in Forbidden Planet. There's a moment towards the end of that movie where the monsters of the id on the planet, I think it's Altair 4, are attacking the last people there, and they're, like, heating up the door to the point of white-hot intensity, and it looks very, very much like, you know, the door heating up and falling apart when Qui-Gon is attacking it. That's turning the Jedi into the monsters of the id, which is a very interesting thing and a very interesting idea.
Well, to the Trade Federation, they are the monsters.
Yeah. And there are a bunch of other, like, little shout-outs here and there. Like, whenever you're on Coruscant, the movie briefly can turn into, like, Metropolis or Blade Runner. It definitely turns into Blade Runner and Attack of the Clones. There's like a shot that's like a direct blaming out loud shout out to Blade Runner in that movie. But like you also have other things like, you know, say like the Ben-Hur moment, you know, the pod race scene here. The fact that it's all very, very clearly based on the designs and the pacing and the general atmosphere of Ben-Hur. It's meaningful in to the, you know, to the extent that, like, you know, you have Anakin Skywalker, who we find out here, you know, Darth Vader, we find out, is a literal virgin birth. He's the Jesus Christ.
Oh, yeah. Don't even get me started on that.
But here's the thing, though.
Yeah.
Ben-Hur, you have to remember, is a story of the Christ. That's its subtitle.
Okay.
You know, like, the chariot race in that movie happens right before, you know, Charlton Heston goes and, like, starts sitting in on Jesus' sermons. That's, like, what the movie is really supposed to be about. It's really supposed to get you fired up about Jesus. All it really does is get you fired up about chariot races.
Yeah, and gladiator stuff.
But, like, it's meaningful that, you know, Anakin starts out a slave on a desert planet.
Uh-huh.
In a race that is very, very clearly based on the chariot races, because that helps you understand this as a, you know, as an embodiment of the colonial mentality that Tatooine is experiencing in regards to the Republic.
Right.
And we, you know, we see in this movie that, you know, the people on Tatooine are so remote and disconnected from the Republic that their money doesn't work there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the laws don't work there. There's supposed to be laws against slavery, and, you know, guess what?
It doesn't work on this planet.
Yep, it doesn't work on that planet. They've got bombs buried and implanted under their skin, and if they stray too far, they get blown up. So the fact that you have this race that is very, very clearly based on, you know, the Roman chariot races, mm-hmm. it forces you to think about, like, well, gee, there's something kind of corrupt going on in the Republic then, isn't there? And, you know, even, like, down to the fact that, like, Jabba the Hutt is in the Pontius Pilate position.
Right.
That, I mean, I love that because...
It's like the world's biggest, like, mob guy.
Yeah, the world's
biggest... He's totally mobbed up.
You're right. The world's biggest mob guy is being equated to, you know, the guy who washes his hands of Jesus' death. Or should I say, the guy who washes his hands of Jesus' death is equated to this huge mob guy. Which is a great thing for me because, like, when I was growing up going to church as a little kid, I'm thinking to myself, like... Why, you know, like, I was asking, like, why aren't we, like, mad at Pontius Pilate for, like, sanctioning the death of Jesus? And, like, a priest would tell me something like, oh, well, he washed his hands of it. You know, the guilt isn't on his hands. And I'm like, wait, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, that makes it cowardly.
Mm-hmm.
So to see Pontius Pilate equated to Jabba the Hutt is kind of beautiful in my mind.
Mm.
But yeah, there's so much stuff going on there, and like writers like there's a writer named Anne Lancashire who has talked at length about, you know, the Ben-Hur thing going on in the pod race I mean, it's really worth checking out. If you can, look up Anne Lancashire. I think it's something like repetition, variation, integration, and it really talks about about all the different ways that like Lucas uses echoes and homages both within his own films and to other films outside of that. But it also really talks about the politics that are going on here with the whole, like, pod race, chariot race thing.
But wait a second. I want to get back to this area where you're talking about, like, this virgin birth and, like, you know, basically setting Anakin up for being, like, Jesus. Is he evil Jesus? What's the deal?
You know, there is something so brilliant about that I love. I love the fact that, one... Having Anakin Skywalker as a virgin birth is both a great way to have, like, this divine figure in this mythology that you're building. And remember, like, George Lucas, he's, like, doing the Joseph Campbell thing. He is trying to build his own little mythology here.
Right.
But at the same time, it's also, like, a great little commentary on Christianity and, like, the institution. We see the Jedi as an establishment... are utterly orthodox, utterly conservative, utterly
right. The Pharisees of their time.
But at the same time, the fact that your Messiah figure turns out to be the greatest villain known to man.
Ah, but wait, you know they keep bringing that up. They keep on saying.
Well, I mean, like that's a great little commentary there. He is not just, you know, the Christ who is crucified. He is the Christ who will persecute and crucify other people, and that's what Darth Vader becomes. So, I mean, like, that show, to me, that's a message about the lure of Messiah figures in general. If you spend too much time believing in this person and believing that they're going to be the savior and end-all, and you put all of your faith into them, there's a good chance that you're going to get a monster out of that.
Yeah, but the main point of the whole thing is... he carried through on his deal. The prophecy was what? What was the prophecy?
To restore balance to the Force.
And he restored balance to the Force. There was a whole bunch of good guys in the room. Hey, we're all good guys. We're all good. There's no bad guys. No bad guys here. And they're like, there's Sith? Nah, there ain't no Sith. He brought back balance. You know, suddenly there started to be all this Sith around.
True, but also remember, as we see in this movie, the good guys are not really as cracked up. They're not what they were cracked up to be.
Yeah, and easily duped.
Yeah, they're easily duped. They are, and as we see in the other movies, they are willing to accept pretty big moral compromises.
Yeah, cheating on
oh, I'm not even talking about that.
Chance, no.
Like, I'm not even talking about the stuff that Qui-Gon does here, which is unorthodox, but it's generally okay. But, like, as we see later in Attack of the Clones and the Clone Wars, they get up to some, like, Philip K. Dick level badness.
Is it Philip K. Dick move?
Yeah, there you go, Philip K. Dick move. When you allow an army being made out of clones and sending them out to die, like a whole army of replicants,
that is
at least morally gray, you have to admit.
So now you're getting to the point. Do these replicants have lives? Do they have rights? Do they have slaves? Do slaves have rights?
Yeah.
Or are they property? Are they chattel?
Yeah, this is a little bit of like the cyberpunk thing that I think is there in The Phantom Menace. It's not there to the same extent that you're going to see it in Attack of the Clones, and definitely not in The Clone Wars.
They're building it.
Yeah, they're building it. And then in The Clone Wars, I think, is really rewarding for people who are into different types of science fiction, because there's a lot of stuff that's going on there that's worth checking out. But you get a little bit of it here. And that was one of the things that I thought was really great. The Phantom Menace was the first Star Wars movie that felt like, to me, we were getting more than just Star Wars influences. There's a whole lot of stuff going on there that's really interesting. You know, say, like, the infamous midichlorian scenes.
Ah, yes. It was up to 2000!
Right. The infamous midichlorian scene where, like, you know, what is it? Obi-Wan is checking Anakin's midichlorian count for, you know, Qui-Gon.
Didn't ask his mom's permission.
Right. You have a whole lot of red light, and Obi-Wan is looking at this screen where he's seeing, like, these little miniature anime explosions on the screen fill out. That brought to me right back to the movie Akira.
Oh, definitely Akira.
Where they look at Tetsuo's power level and compare it to Akira's, and what do you have? You have the colonel and the scientist. They're in a room filled with red light, and they're looking at this little holographic anime explosion. And it's, right, it's basically the same thing. What they're reading in that moment is they're scientifically reading his, like, psychic...
His levels are off the charts!
Right, exactly. And that's the sort of... That's another one of those little things that I think I was primed for and accepting to because of anime. Because, like, when Obi-Wan says, his midichlorian counts are off the charts, over 20,000, all I had to do was watch that and think, yeah, that sounds like something Vegeta would say. So I'm accepting of that. I accept that as one of the things you can have in one of these movies. Or, like, you know,
But who's to say, you know, it's because he's supposed to be Jedi Jesus, so we accept this, like, that a midichlorian count, you know, I'm sure this has been debated over time, like, as opposed to, like, the Force, if everybody, what do they say? Everybody has access to the Force, right? Everybody, is the Force for everybody, but seems stronger than others, in others, so what's up with that?
Well, I think that's just one of those places where people look a little bit too hard on these things sometimes, like, we always knew that there were some people who had more of, you know, a natural adeptness at the Force.
We're all equal, but some are more equal than others. Is that what you're saying?
I think it's more like, you know, everybody can play basketball, but just because you can pick up a ball and shoot it into a hoop, that doesn't make you Michael fucking Jordan.
Okay.
You know, Luke is Michael Jordan. Han is just some guy who, like, sits on the couch and says, oh, I could have done that.
Yeah.
And he couldn't have done that. You know, he couldn't have done that.
Mm-hmm.
What I like is that you have these other things that are coming into it. You have more of a rich mythology that's coming in. Like, I think Star Wars eventually did benefit from having something like the Clone Wars, where you could take a really long time to tell these stories in the same way that, like, Game of Thrones takes 10 hours a year to tell you a story, or the way that, like, Dune really needs a whole lot of time to
tell. It needs a gigantic miniseries.
Yeah, like if you need...
It needs a maxi-series.
Right, like, if Dune is going to make sense, you basically need several seasons just for one book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that big, it's that dense, there's that much going on in Arrakis.
Yeah, you aren't going to trot that out in one movie. I don't care, even if you got David Lynch directing it.
Right. And I think The Phantom Menace does a pretty good job of setting up these things and setting them up on a pretty simple level. They could have done a whole lot better setting up the Sith and who they are at times.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think sometimes that they could have spent a little bit more time talking about the politics and what's going on here. But as we've seen from other people's reactions, they probably got away with about as much as they humanly could.
Yeah, too much talking. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, but even when you have all that talking, you have like a design like the Senate. And I'll always love the Senate. Even before like you got like Yoda fighting the Emperor in there and like tossing shit at each other, I love just the way that it looks. I remember seeing that and hearing somebody say, oh, it looks like bumper cars in space. And I thought to myself, well, if you can think of a better metaphor for politics than that, be my guest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the fact that, like, this is also the funny thing that's going on. Around the time of The Phantom Menace, or I guess this was, like, in 2000, it was, like, right when the year was changing, Tom Tomorrow had a bunch of, like, this modern world style cartoons that he drew for Time magazine. And one of the things that he was doing, like, he was imagining a world 100 years in the future or something mm-hmm. like that. And among the things that he predicted, including, you know, Donald Trump's cryogenically preserved brain being president of the United States.
Get out!
One of the other things that he predicted was, like, full corporate membership in the United States Senate. So you have, like, a robot Bill Gates arguing with a robot representative from the Coca-Cola Corporation as senators. I look at that and I think, well, that's great, Tom Tomorrow, but George Lucas beat you to that already with the senator from the Trade Federation. And that is a pitch-perfect sci-fi metaphor for corruption in politics. And that's just, you know, it's what we have right now where we can't get a gun control bill passed through either house of Congress because the NRA keeps buying off people and preventing things from getting through. It's what keeps us from having any real legislation on things like, you know, the minimum wage or, you know, corporate financing of elections or even, you know, tax shelters often like the Caribbeans and stuff like that. You know, one of the best ways to think about what's going on in The Phantom Menace is, here is a corporation that is not content to simply find a tax shelter. They want to invade a planet and create a tax shelter. This is like, you know, right, this is like the IRS comes knocking on the door of Goldman Sachs, and Goldman Sachs sends Blackwater to wipe them out.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what you have here. And that's, you know, among the stuff that I was thinking about when I was seeing this for the first time and, you know, wanting to go ride off and join the protests at, like, the Battle of Seattle, you know, and stuff like that. So, you know, those are all the things that, like, appeal to me, plus the novelty of the design. I mean, there are times in this movie where, you know, it feels like you're not really watching Star Wars anymore. It feels like you're watching an anime come to life, you know what I mean?
I definitely see that.
Yeah. I mean, some of the way the battle droids look, it's very Iria, the Zerum animation and stuff like that. There's a whole lot in this movie.
And I love the whole, the different alien races. And you know what? I'll give good shout out to the Gungans, which a lot of people get pissed off about the Jar Jars and the things like that. But you have to keep, you were saying this, that's for the kids.
Yeah.
It's for the kids.
I think, you know, there's a self-awareness that the movie has to it because there's a number of scenes where you have Jar Jar, like, doing something or saying something, and everybody around him just kind of rolling their eyes or getting annoyed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, say Jar Jar does his Yoshi trick and sticks out his tongue to get a piece of food. Qui-Gon catches his tongue and says, "Don't do that again." That is a moment where you know, George Lucas is saying to the audience, "Yeah, I get that this guy is annoying, but your kids like him, so deal with it."
They always have very strong female characters. Well, wait a second. Isn't this the movie that they were complaining that the only two characters basically was the princess, her handmaidens, and the mom? That's it. That's the only females in the whole film.
True, but that's enough to make this the very first Star Wars movie that actually passes the Bechdel test.
Dun dun dun.
there you go. I mean, like, there is a scene where Padme and Anakin's mom are talking to each other, and they're not talking about a man, they're talking about politics.
Right.
So there you go. Padme is being a strong character, and is able to be strong in ways besides just getting into gunfights and stuff, although she does get to do that.
Yeah, and she's a darn crack good shot.
Yeah, she's good. But I like the fact that we get this whole little political side story for her. We get to see what it looks like to have a woman in power. You know, it's meaningful that we get to see Padme in the Senate making moves, making decisions for herself. Even though she's a pawn, she does make the decision to go back to Naboo on her own, despite, you know, Palpatine objecting and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So we get to see her as a real leader.
Mm.
And, you know, the other funny thing is this was happening around the same time that people were starting to talk about, you know, is Hillary going to run for the Senate?
And well,
stuff like
and
that.
Look now.
Yeah, there you go. You know,
all right, so here's my question. Can I ask favorite scenes? You tell me your favorite scene from the movie, and I'll tell you my favorite scene. Go ahead.
It's funny, looking at it now, like, a lot of my favorite stuff tends to be a lot of the stuff on Naboo at the beginning. Like, I love,
really?
Like, there's a lot of stuff that I like there just for, like, for the sheer visual sense of it. Like, I love the fact that seeing, like, much to the, you know, opposition of people who insist that the Star Wars prequels are all digital or all synthetic, I love the fact that they actually went to Italy to, like, palaces to shoot so many of these scenes.
Mm.
It gives you this such an old world feeling, which is a nice thing to have in these movies that you're used to just seeing, you know, battleship gray Death Star interiors and stuff like that, or the cantina. It's nice to have a place that looks kind of like the Vatican, where they're having, like, their action scenes, or the battle droids are walking people, you know, to different locations and stuff. One of the things that it made me feel when I was watching that stuff, you know, all the parts of Naboo that look like they're from Dorne in Game of Thrones.
Right, right.
It gives
these
you the
palazzos.
It gives me this big feeling of, like, taking a stroll through the cloisters and everything.
Mm.
I like having that feeling when I'm watching a movie, and I definitely get that from the Naboo portions. I also really love the Coruscant stuff, simply because Coruscant is, like, Planet Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
You've got all this, like, art deco beauty and goodness. You've got these floating platforms and everything. You've got the Senate, which is, you know, this, I mean, it's like something out of the dreams of Frank Lloyd Wright and Albert Speer all at once. It's really beautiful stuff, and it's really beautiful visual filmmaking. The type of stuff that I like seeing in this type of escapist fantasy fair, and I feel that's sort of going missing in a lot of other stuff. Like, when you watch an Iron Man movie or you watch an Avengers movie, you're usually sitting in, like, a location that looks like it could be the set of an NCIS episode. There's not a whole lot going on there.
Mm-hmm.
I like seeing that the floor of the Jedi Temple has all these, like, you know, ornate details, and they have, like, mandalas on the, you know,
mm-hmm.
in the design and everything, so there's a lot there. And, of course, I love stuff like the Duel of the Fates.
Ah, dude, you're swiping my favorite scene.
Let
me throw in a little here, because I was saying, upon this viewing, I was noticing, we're going here, I'm getting through everything, and right when I feel like my strength of watching this film is ebbing, I'm like, the elevator doors open, and dude, there's Darth Maul, and Duel of the Fates comes on. I was like, oh, shit.
Let's talk about Darth Maul. Darth Maul is, like, if there is one character who
he's stands, MVP of this.
If there is one character who stands for everything that is good about The Phantom Menace, it's Darth Maul. And
okay.
It's not just because he's this quote-unquote badass villain character.
Uh-huh.
It's because here is a character who could have just been, like, a phoned-in, you know, Sith Lord in a mask. You're like, you could have taken one of, like, Ralph McQuarrie's old designs for Darth Vader
uh-huh.
and used that for Darth Maul. Nobody would have complained. Instead, you get this, you know, devil with a crown of horns.
Who designed this? Do you know the designer?
I think that's it's either Ryan Church or Ian McKaig. There's a lot of really great designers who worked on this movie.
Oh yeah, plays beautiful all the way
like
around.
Doug Chang did the battle droids, and I love the fact that the battle droids, they look like they are actually appliances. They don't look like they're robots that are made to look scary in an artificial way, like the Terminator robots.
All their other robots are basically little, really super skinny. What's up with
yeah,
that?
I really like that. They look like they're designed to be mass-produced. They look like they're designed right. to fold up.
Yeah, when they bring them out.
Right,
yeah,
and stuff
they roll
like that.
Them out, literally.
There's a lot of really beautiful designs in this movie, and Darth Maul is chief among them. He's got this great, you know, like the horns around his head are like a crown. He's got, you know, the, you know, mottled face of red and black that you don't know if it's tattooed or if he's born that way.
Mm-hmm. Not enough words about it.
And then, of course, you've got the double-bladed lightsaber,
mm-hmm.
which is great because it gives you a different type of action.
Fanboys lose their mind when they saw that.
Yeah, and what's odd today is that I look at people talking about it, complaining that, oh, it's all flash and no substance. Like you're like they're just looking to hear dialogue in a sword fight.
Oh, really? No, thank you. I don't need another Senate meeting in the middle of our thing here. Thank
right.
you.
I'm really glad. Right, and that's one of the things that I like about the movie. It goes from lots and lots of talk to lots and lots of action. It has that kind of bipolar sensibility.
And it has a little break in there where yeah. even Qui-Gon could sit and meditate in between this.
Oh,
thing.
I love that. The scene where Qui-Gon is meditating, that to me, that one shot of him kneeling down, meditating in the middle of the fight, that is a summation of what it means to be a Jedi mm-hmm. at that moment. Being at peace with yourself, being at peace with the possibility of death, and just carrying on with that kind of Zen calmness. That's really beautiful.
As soon as it finished, he was just right back in the action.
Yeah. And to me, I look at that and I think to myself, is there a whole lot of talking like there was in, like, the other duels in Star Wars? No. But instead, we get this, like, it's like a silent movie at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need dialogue there. You can just have the pure visual experience of it. What's interesting there to me is the fact that, like, the double-bladed lightsaber gives you a different type of action that allows you to have two heroes fighting one person.
Mm-hmm. So it shows you how awesome he must be.
Well, it's,
to
well, it's not
both
just
of
that. It also gives you a type of duel that you had never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that I like the most about The Phantom Menace. It gives you so many things in Star Wars that you've never seen before.
So are you saying that this new one wasn't good because it gives you everything that you've seen before?
That's one thing. It's also the problem that I had like with The Force Awakens is that everything in it was something that you'd seen before, and it wasn't even all the stuff that you had seen before. It was very choosy about the stuff that it was going to have. Like, say, when you have their version of the attack on the Death Star,
mm-hmm.
in the original Star Wars, you had X-Wings, you had Y-Wings. In this version, you just have X-Wings.
Because, I think they were thinking a lot about the marketing.
They were thinking about the marketing, but, like, that's the thing that bothers me about the movie. I don't care if you're thinking about the marketing and it's prompting you to do creative things. Like, say, even, like, in the original trilogy movies, every time they had a new battle, it was lots of new stuff. Like, say, for Empire Strikes Back, you had the walkers. You had the snow spears with the harpoon guns. You had a different type of scene. For, you know, Return of the Jedi, you had lots of new ships. You had A-wings. You had B-wings. You had the TIE interceptors. Even the Death Star itself looked different.
Mm-hmm.
For the prequels, you had dozens of new ships, dozens of new aliens, lots of stuff like this going on.
Keep Kenner busy.
Yeah. But for The Force Awakens, you have X-Wings, and the only thing that makes them different from the original movies is the paint color is different. So that's something, I mean, like, I really hate that, you know, cautious approach, that conservative approach. You know, watching The Force Awakens, it felt like a movie you'd seen before a number of times. That's what a lot of fans like
about
it.
But that draws them old fans in and also to get the new fans primed.
Well, the thing is, I feel like the newer fans are the one, like the newer fans did not give a fuck about the X-Wings and all of the old shit. You know what the newer fans want?
What?
The newer fans want Finn and Poe to hook up.
Oh.
That's what they want.
Do you think they'll do it?
If Disney doesn't do that, they are going to inspire a rebellion by Tumblr, the likes of which the world has never seen.
Well, you know what? There's a lot of people that don't use Tumblr. But I will tell you this. For God's sake, give Elsa a girlfriend. Either way.
Give Elsa a boyfriend. And,
a girlfriend.
You know, yeah, a girlfriend.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Captain America.
Give Captain America a boyfriend? Oh, okay, his name is Bucky. Ba-dum-bum.
Yeah, there you go. Hey, that's where people's minds are. That's what they care about. And hey, if they don't include that sort of thing in, you know, with Poe and Finn, and it feels like at the best moments of that movie, it feels like they're sort of aiming in that direction. Uh-huh. Like, say, the moment where Poe gives Finn the jacket.
Uh-huh. They hearken it back to other incidents with jackets and stuff like that.
I mean, like, you know, Rebel Without a Cause.
Oh, sure.
Rebel Without a Cause, you know, Sal Mineo
right.
takes James Dean's jacket. And what I love about that, the idea that that sort of thing is going on in Star Wars, remember, there's no bigger Rebel Without a Cause fan than George Lucas.
Uh-huh. So, oh, but wait, but he had no part of this.
He didn't have any part of it. Well, apparently the characters of Rey, Poe, and Finn, their antecedents were originated from Lucas.
Okay, so he came up with those characters.
He had them with different names, like Rey was going to be called Kira or something.
Okay.
But those, these young characters are the ones that George Lucas worked on, and, you know, a lot of his stuff was thrown out, but the stuff that everybody likes...
is the stuff that came from him.
Yeah, or at least some of it. So there you go. But I mean, like, I like the idea that we have a character pairing like that that is not going against the grain of Star Wars. That's actually one of the few things that feels like it is deeply in part of the movies and is deeply in part of, you know, the cinematic instincts that George Lucas had. Like, look at a movie like American Graffiti. That is a movie cut from the very same cloth of Rebel Without a Cause.
Okay.
And it's a movie that, like, you look at that, and then you look at Poe Finn, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there you go.
All right.
What are you going to do? I'd love to see things like that. I'd love to see new types of stuff going on in Star Wars, but as long as Disney is doing it...
Oh, right. I almost forgot where I was.
Right. You're probably going to be lucky if, like, they... You're going to be lucky if you aren't find, like, another cantina jammed down your throat. This is the stuff that I love most about The Phantom Menace. It is a Star Wars movie unlike anything else you've seen. That can be a good thing, that can be a bad thing, but at the very least, it has its own identity. It is the Star Wars movie that got me back into Star Wars, along with all the, you know, other things that I'm a fan of. And it's the one that I'll keep going back to, because I do feel like... I feel like I've outgrown the original trilogy, but because there's so much stuff in The Phantom Menace that you almost need to be a postgraduate just to wrap your head around,
right.
It's always going to come back and reward you. So, at the end of the day, that is my favorite Star Wars movie, and I'm glad it's here.
Wow, at number 100.
And that's it for Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. Number 100 on the Wonders in the Dark countdown of the greatest science fiction films of all time. Make sure to visit Wonders in the Dark and keep up with the countdown to see if your favorite sci-fi movies made the final tally. And hey, if The Phantom Menace got in, I'm sure something you like has a decent chance too. I'll be back at the end of the month for my next pieces in the countdown. They'll both be animated, if you want a hint. And make sure to look up Checkerboard Kids and NeoWestchester.com. Until then, this is Bob Clark of Cinemaville, reminding you, a real masterpiece isn't something that nobody argues about. A real masterpiece is something that you love enough to argue about in the first place.